Commons People this week: Boris Johnson under pressure over trade and investment from China.
China thinks this is a matter of their national security and essential to their sovereignty. If Italy, if Brussels, if the United States, if other countries agree and other entities agree, why don't you?
And what now for Keir Starmer and Labour after their Batley boost?
Will members opposite forgive me if I just turn round to look at the new member for Batley and Spen as she sits there on these benches beneath the plaque to Jo Cox, her sister?
Hello and welcome to Commons People, HuffPost UK's politics podcast. I'm Ned Symonds, HuffPost's politics news editor, and I'm joined by Paul Waugh. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Ned. Nice to see you again.
And our guest this week is Labour Shadow International Trade Secretary Emily Thornberry. Hi, Emily. How's it going?
Hi. All right, thanks.
We're recording this on Thursday afternoon, the day after England beat Denmark to make it through to the finals of the Euros. Paul, I know you're a big football fan. How are you feeling this morning, or this afternoon, in fact?
Just relieved and drained, I think, like everyone else. I'm still think it's a bit of a dream, put it that way. I'm sure Emily's constituents feel the same.
Yeah. Everybody was up very late last night. There was an awful lot of kind of driving around and honking and all of that going on. It was amazing. I think it's been such a long time. I mean, I remember the Danish goalkeeper was asked, wasn't he, you know, are you going to stop football coming home? And he just said, well, has it ever been home? And of course, we've never won the European Championship. So it's really amazing. It's something else, isn't it?
Yeah, totally.
We'll be returning to that topic at the end for the quiz. And I think like a sharp turn away from that, something a bit more serious. Talk about trade, Emily, which is your brief. And let's start with China. Boris Johnson was at the Commons Liaison Committee yesterday being grilled by MPs. And here's a clip of Foreign Affairs Committee Chairman and, let's say, China skeptic Tom Tugendhat taking the PM to task over the purchase of the UK's producer of semiconductors by a Chinese-owned manufacturer.
Prime Minister, if I may, there is a difference between investment, which is looking for a normal return, to the purchase of technology. And what we're seeing here from Nexperia, which, as you know, is a company that is mostly owned, actually, by a Chinese state-backed firm, we're seeing a Chinese state-backed entity buying a semiconductor manufacturer at a time of global shortage when Beijing is already looking for to stockpile semiconductors. Now, if China thinks this is a matter of their national security and essential to their sovereignty, if Italy, if Brussels, if the United States, if other countries agree and other entities agree, why don't you?
I think semiconductors are of huge importance to this country. And one of the things that I wanted to look at immediately that I became Prime Minister was whether or not we could become more self-reliant. And I'm told it costs about £9 billion for us to build a proper semiconductor factory. It's a lot of money, particularly during a pandemic, where we're thinking about what to do. There is this company, they make a lot of semiconductors in Ireland, as you know. But there is this company in Newport. We have to judge whether the stuff that they are making is real intellectual property value and interest to China, whether the real security implications. I've asked the National Security Advisor.
He told the committee he doesn't want anti-China spirit to lead the UK to, quote, pitchfork away from every Chinese investment. Emily, Labour has kind of suggested the UK could potentially boycott the 2022 Winter Olympics in China over human rights. Do you think the government and the Prime Minister is taking too soft a line on Beijing when it comes to engagement and trade?
Well, I think the first thing is that they've just never been consistent. I think that it's absolutely right that we don't allow Chinese investment into essential infrastructure, but it's kind of already started to happen. I have a cat walking in front of me.
Wonderful.
Leave that in.
The point is that we have to be really careful about what we agree to and what we don't agree to, and this is essential infrastructure. And I think that what the Prime Minister was asked about was again about essential infrastructure. I don't think that it's a good idea for there to be foreign investment in industries such as that. And I think that also, you know, we've seen in the past the, you know, different versions of this Conservative government. So under Cameron and Osborne, you know, they were going, they're trolling off to China and being praised by the Chinese press as being, you know, isn't it great to have these overseas leaders coming to China and them not criticizing us for our human rights record? And the same when Theresa May went over, and now we have a different, well, sometimes, not always, sometimes a different attitude to China. We should just be consistent and we should just be straightforward and just say, you know, we want to be able to work with China, but frankly, there are things that we disagree with, and just always be clear about it. And for the Chinese to be, you know, to suddenly be criticized about the Uyghurs, for example, is something that, you know, they'd be thinking to themselves, well, hang on a minute, they haven't been criticizing us on that before, or, you know, they've told us that they don't have a problem with us investing in our nuclear power stations, and yet now they're saying that they don't want us to invest in other parts of critical infrastructure. I think that we need to have a proper strategy and we need to be consistent.
Do you think, kind of, what are the kind of concrete steps you think the government would take, or you would take if you're in government, to have that strategy with Beijing? The particular things you think you could do now or you would do if you're in government?
Okay, so how about let's start with Xinjiang and imports from Xinjiang. So the government say it's up to the responsibility of companies as to whether or not product that has been made by Uyghurs, and there are certainly quite strong allegations that the Uyghurs are being essentially used for slave labor. You know, should we be buying shirts that are made from cotton from Xinjiang? And what the government says is, well, it's up to individual companies to decide on this. We will leave it to them. Well, I mean, there's certainly something about that. And I'm not saying that there isn't a role for that. And I think that we should look quite carefully at looking at legislation that might give additional responsibility to companies to look carefully at their supply chains and see where they get their various product from. But I think we can go further than that. And if you look at what the Americans are now doing, you know, the Americans not only expect their companies to behave in a particular way, but also, you know, the customs are sitting on the border checking to see what's coming in and where it's come from. I met a company, it was amazing. I really was very cynical when they told me this is what they were going to tell me about. But they can tell by the, I think it's the DNA of the cotton, where it has come from. It's amazing. Wow. And so they're helping the Americans to say, right, you can't have that shirt because that shirt does come from Xinjiang.
Wow.
Extraordinary. Anyway, the point is we should be looking at this. Why aren't we doing this? Why aren't we serious? You know, we could, you know, this government's very good at talking about things, but they don't actually do anything. This would be something that we could do now. I think the other thing in the end as well is, if you look at, right, after Tiananmen Square, there was a, in the UN Human Rights Committee, the Chinese were just like inches away from being condemned by that committee on their human rights record. And they really changed their tactics. And you know, I know you know this, Ned. They went around the world, you know, investing in those very countries that were about to be highly critical of China. And then a year later, guess what? they kind of changed their tune. And what Biden is saying, and I think he's right, is that the only way to redress the balance really is to look again at what investment is being made internationally and to just not leave it to the Chinese and their Belt and Road Initiative. I am surprised, I am shocked and disappointed that there has been so little condemnation from many countries that I would expect about what's happening to the Uyghurs. I mean, countries that identify as a Muslim country are saying very little about the Uyghurs.
And do you think, Emily, that the UK could do more to support nations in the region and in around China?
Well, yes, I mean, I think that's right, you see. And I think that the point is that, well, I think that it also needs to be tied in as well to not just investment in those countries, but I think that we also need to have a human rights thread going through the way in which we use our aid, but also the way in which we trade and in our foreign policy. I think all of these things, you know, should be strung together a bit more than they are. So the work that we do and our priorities, and so that we are consistent, and so that, you know, so that so that we're not striking up trade deals with countries and just closing our eyes to particular things that are happening within those countries, but making it clear, you know, a trade deal with us means that you get preferential treatment because you're our friend. But as a friend, we expect you to behave in this way. And if you don't, then we're going to start pulling away from that trade deal. I mean, that's what a human rights clause is, real human rights clauses ought to be.
And obviously the Beijing regime.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions, talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Obviously doesn't like people who engage with, for example, Taiwan. What's your view on that?
Well, I mean, Taiwan exists, and I think that they know that that they need to be, everyone needs to be a little bit more pragmatic about it. In fact, I think, I mean, I'm actually meeting the Taiwanese representative after this podcast, Kelly Che. So I'm going to be talking to him about the Trans-Pacific Partnership and concerns that he has about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and I imagine concerns that he has about what future China might have in relation to the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Because what's interesting is, you know, when you chat about, I'm like, can I just say this? Because I'm one of the few countries in the people in the country that can actually say this. When we're talking about CPTPP, see, I can just like, it rolls off my tongue. Nobody else, very few other people can do this. Other people have to talk about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, but I can do CPTPP because I've been doing this job for a year, so I can now say it. But nobody really knows what CPTPP is. I mean, when they did a consultation, they only got 81 responses. And we've moved out of one big trade bloc, the European Union, and we seem to be about to move back into another one, CPTPP, and nobody really knows what it's all about. I've asked them 237 questions about it. They haven't answered them yet. But the point is this. One of the questions is, who are the other members of CPTPP going to be? Because China keeps saying that it wants to join.
Uh-huh.
And the question is, are they going to join or not? Are we going to join first? Would they be allowed to join afterwards? Will we be able to boycott them joining? Mm. You know, what the government has said in their document, which is their scoping document about the discussions they're going to have on CPTPP, is that they are relying on there being an agreement that other countries would not be allowed to join unless they have similar trading rules and a similar economy to those that are already in the Trans-Pacific Partnership. So they say that's enough. I say, you haven't thought this through. I say, first of all, I'm really disappointed that your only objection to another country joining, like China, is their economy, when just a few months ago, when there was the threat, as the government saw it, of an amendment to the trade bill, which was all about genocide, and particularly about the Uyghurs and the way the Uyghurs were being treated. And if you remember just how kind of bullish the government were being about how appalling the treatment of the Uyghurs was and how appalling human rights and now their only objection to China, us joining a trade agreement with China, is if their economy is different and not on the basis of human rights. I just put that out there just to show how they just have a blind spot when it comes to this sort of stuff. But I also think that even if the Chinese were told that they would need to be changing their economy and changing the way in which they trade, I think that there are certainly quite strong elements within the Chinese government who would see that as a positive external driver for reform. I think that there are people within the government of China who would like their economy to change and would like there to be external pressure that would then kind of help to push that change. And so they might well find themselves saying, well, in order to get ourselves prepared to join the Trans-Pacific Partnership, we need to change our economy this way or that way. And indeed, they may find themselves with friends in the Trans-Pacific Partnership who will say, well, China isn't ready yet, but China's promised that it will get on that path. Let's loosen the rules up a bit and let's, you know, let them be on that. And indeed, you know, countries like, I don't know, Malaysia, South Korea, Thailand, you know, countries who are kind of thinking that they're going to join or they might join the Trans-Pacific Partnership, but they're hesitating because they think the rules are too strong, might actually be quite like the idea of, it's a little bit, you know what it reminds me of? It's a bit like some of the countries who are in the European Union who are supposed to have joined the Euro, but who are just taking years and years and years over it. And everyone's fine about that, you know, but it could be like that with the Trans-Pacific Partnership. It could just end up being a much looser organization and you would then get all kinds of countries in there. Anyway, this is a long segue into just, you know, what is the future and what's our future relationship with China, and have they really thought these things through? Because when you ask them questions, they just look at you with dead eyes. They just don't seem to be thinking this stuff through. And you need to have a proper strategy that you have thought about, that you have discussed with the rest of the cabinet, and that you're all going in the same direction together, you know?
On Taiwan, I mean, Beijing has got upset at three US senators visiting Taiwan. I mean, do you think there's a danger of them trying to bully Western politicians and having no engagement with Taiwan?
Well, I mean, the bottom and top of it is that there is engagement with Taiwan, you know, and there will continue to be engagement with Taiwan. And I don't believe that the Chinese government is so lacking in pragmatism that they really expect to kind of push Taiwan off the island and into the sea. I mean, it's not going to happen, is it? You know, so, you know, an accommodation needs to be made and is made. I don't think that the Chinese at the moment are going through a particularly anti-Taiwanese phase.
So you mentioned the cabinet, Emily, and Conservative Home's survey of Tory members recently showed that Liz Truss was the most popular cabinet minister amongst Tories. I guess because, you know, she's signed off lots of trade deals. You know, does she deserve any credit there? Or
somebody said, I'm not going to say who, but anyway, somebody within the Department for International Trade said recently that DIT stands for the Department for Instagramming Truss. I'm not going to pretend that she doesn't have lots of strengths, because she does. You know, she's fun and lively, but there are definitely drawbacks. I mean, I think, you know, the gossip is that, you know, she writes on documents. Too long didn't read, with sort of dead eyes on. You know, if you give her too much stuff in a red box, she just won't read the stuff. And I mean, I think, you know, she does a kind of a little bit of a sort of Margaret Thatcher tribute act a wee bit, you know, and it's a kind of, you know, she's harbinger, she's the holder of the flame these days for the sort of Thatcherites. There's something about her. Mm. And, you know, when you see her appear in the chamber, you know, the right of the Tory party all pitch up as her kind of cheer, you know, as her gang. So that's kind of interesting politics going on. And I think that certainly plays to the membership quite well. And yes, there are lots of photographs of her shaking the hands of people signing deals around the world. And so giving the impression of a sort of, you know, forward movement initiative. It's interesting how she will take no responsibility for patching the deal that we really need, which is the biggest trade deal, which is the trade deal with the European Union, you know, which have great glaring holes. And you would think that the Secretary of State for International Trade would take some responsibility for ensuring that those holes were repaired. And furthermore, that any international trade deals that we did were consistent with the biggest trade deal that we have, which is the one with the European Union. But you can't see her for dust. You know, she won't engage on the issue of trade with Europe. Her department does. You know, most of her department actually work across Europe, you know, trying to kind of, you know, facilitate trade. But in terms of political initiatives, which is what we need at the moment, we need to repair this really thin deal. It's like gossamer, you know, the deal that we have at the moment with the European Union. And we do need it to be something which is properly functioning.
Yeah, that's interesting. For a while, it felt like Labour was perhaps quite quiet about Brexit after the deal was signed. Do you think the party needs to sort of be louder about that then? And the flaws in the deal, as you suggest, do you think that's what the party needs to take on going forward?
I think these things have their time. And I think that, you know, we've had a lot of things. I think it's becoming more obvious, more manifest what the problems are with the deal. You know, and we kept, because it was all kind of, you know, covered over by COVID and, you know, by the government continually telling us that it was just teething problems. Well, this far out from the deal, we can now, when businesses come to see me, and they do all the time, and tell me, we've got this problem, we've got this problem, you know, we can start putting together evidence about what the problem is, how it isn't a teething problem, how it needs to be fixed, and start challenging the government on what they should do. And furthermore, to be quite honest, you know, do what we are kind of doing quite a lot of these days, which is not just challenging them on what they should do, but actually telling them what we think they should do and hoping that they do it. You know, that's for me, I mean, that's going to be kind of quite a big part of my role. You know, I'm working with Jenny Chapman, who will be the spokesperson and will be challenging Frost and the Lords. But, you know, we're having a read across in relation to all trade deals, you know, and not like Liz Truss kind of, you know, I'm like Secretary of State for a donut, you know, like trade, but not Europe. No, no, it's all trade we're doing here, you know.
Yeah, that makes me think, actually. It's Rachel Reeves has nibbled at this a bit already, Emily. She said, you know, that our fishermen, our farmers and cultural industries are all suffering because of huge gaps in the deal. And it's as if Labour's now finally prepared to mention the war, that you're more confident about doing that, that you've parked the issue of Brexit. You've said, look, that's decided, but it's the kind of Brexit deal we've got really matters to lots of businesses. Do you think there is now a sort of more of an appetite for you to go out and give your own alternatives on that then? Without necessarily renegotiating the deal. I mean, I suppose that's the last thing you want to do, is renegotiate it. But if you don't renegotiate, how would a Labour government do it differently?
So I think the first thing is, as I said to Ned a minute ago, I mean, I think these things have their own time. And so I think that 6 months out from the deal, I think that we can now start saying, no, really, this, when you say this is a teething problem, it obviously isn't.
It's more like root canal surgery than teething problems.
I'm not going to say that, but certainly, you know, it's obvious that these are problems. And, you know, and we've had within the Shadow Cabinet a number of quite detailed discussions. You know, I've talked to Ed Miliband about it, Lou Hay, you know, Jenny Chapman, as I say, Luke Pollard and Rachel. It impacts on all of our briefs. But unlike what you seem to see with the cabinet, far too often, you will see one cabinet minister saying one thing, another cabinet minister saying something else. They then have a kind of a public fight, and we just see who comes out at the end of it. No, no, no. We have been discussing these things together and what the correct approach is. And this is the approach. It's not, you know, we're not going to start arguing that we need to get back into the European Union, because first of all, we won't be able to join on the same terms that we left. And I think, you know, people need to be aware of that. So whether that's, you know, we'll have to join the Euro, we probably have to join Schengen, we wouldn't get our rebate, you know, there are all of these things that it isn't just kind of in as we used to be or out, no. And in any event, you know, we have a deal now. What we need to do is make sure that deal works, but it's substandard. So we need to make sure that we patch it. And there's all kinds of things that we need to be, you know, to be working on. And the government can't just run away from it. You know, I mean, the number of people, the number of departments that I have challenged and asked them if they were in charge of Brexit, you know, and they all just go, no, 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 not us, not us, and pass the ball to someone else, and then pass the ball to someone else. Well, now we finally have someone who's the guy who actually negotiated the deal. And now we need to start challenging him, you know, and making sure that, you know, the many things that need to be sorted actually are sorted. I mean, it is ridiculous that we don't have a veterinary agreement. You know, it's absolutely ridiculous. And, you know, this is what, as I say, one of our biggest trading partner, we don't have a veterinary agreement. And, you know, you may remember that they always used to say, didn't they, that the thing about leaving the European Union would be that we would, our standards would be better than Europe. That we would have the European Union standards as a baseline, but we would build on those and they would be better. And so if that's right, then why can't we have a veterinary agreement? Why can't we have an agreement on the standard of sausages or whatever it is, you know, that's causing all this trouble? Ham sandwiches of lorry drivers, you know, all of that. I mean, why can't we be just, you know, actually not putting out a barrier to trade, but negotiating a way of getting around it? Well, Lord Frost let the cat out of the bag recently, because he was asked about that. And he said, well, we can't have a veterinary agreement with the European Union because our negotiations with CPTPP are going really well. And it may be that we won't be able to have a veterinary agreement with them that would be consistent with CPTPP. Bingo. They want to lower our standards of our food and our farming. And they can't therefore have an agreement with the European Union because the trade deals that they're negotiating are of a lower standard.
So I think talking about kind of challenging the Conservatives, if we kind of move on to kind of the Labour Party itself, I mean, Labour's victory in Bally and Spen kind of gave Keir Starmer a bit of a spring in his step, I'd say. We've actually got a clip here of Starmer in the Commons yesterday introducing Kim Leadbeater as the new MP.
Mr Speaker, can I also extend a special welcome to the new member for Batley and Spen? And will members opposite forgive me if I just turn round to look at the new member for Batley and Spen as she sits there on these benches beneath the plaque to Jo Cox, her sister? And that's a special and emotional moment for all of us on these benches. And I think for everybody across this House, it takes incredible courage and bravery to stand in that constituency and to sit on these benches beneath that plaque.
And talking to journalists on the day of the result, Starmer said now the kind of pandemic was hopefully receding, the party would have the space to make its argument to the country, just as you were saying there, Emily, about challenging more on the kind of outcome of the deal. What do you think the argument that the party needs to make between now and maybe conference, what does the party need to be doing in the country to get its message across? And what is that message?
So I think you're right. I think that we have been really energised by Batley and Spen. And I think that the Labour Party is never better, actually, than when we've got our back against the wall and we do come back fighting. I think it's important for Keir to be, he's got a programme of work that he wants to do. And he wants to get out and about and not just do a sort of a couple of hours here and a couple of hours there, but to spend, you know, two or three days in particular places, get to know particular parts for the particular parts of the country, to get to know him as well, I think is a really important part of this. And I think that we just need to be, I personally think that we just need to be a confident alternative government to this falling shower that's running the country at the moment. And to speak, you know, clearly and confidently with one voice and say, this won't do. This won't do. This is not the way to do things. We should be doing it this way. You know, as things come up, that's what we should do. Simple.
You're talking about kind of the party having its back against the wall. Do you think there's a danger it's been like that for too long? Is there any concern that, you know, the polls aren't moving enough? The Conservatives are still doing pretty well, despite the, you know, horrendous death toll from the pandemic. You know, is there enough time between now and the election to turn that around?
I think things are incredibly fluid and volatile. Just really don't know where we're going to be in a few months' time. Honestly, none of us do. We've never been through a period like this, you know, and frankly, a Labour leader has never been through a period like this. You know, even Clement Attlee had a you know, short bit of time before the Second World War of being leader of the Labour Party. But, you know, Keir Starmer became leader of the Labour Party, then the pandemic hit. And politics is just unlike politics has ever been before. And it's been really challenging. I'm not going to pretend it isn't, because it has been really challenging. And the central lie, which is, you know, it's annoying, but it is the reality, is that, you know, we have brilliant scientists who have invented a vaccine. You know, some of the best scientists in the world, fantastic. We have our fabulous NHS, centrally run, well organized, able to roll out a centrally organized plan, you know, like that, better than anywhere else in the world. So we get our population vaccinated. The one, frankly, weak link in the chain, in my view, and in the truth, has been our politicians leading this country who have been incapable, as far as I can see, of making decisions in a timely way and being able to articulate what it is that it wants the British public to do in a way which is consistent and helps them. Because the British public are quite happy to do the right thing so long as they're told what the right thing is. And time again, we've had this government vacillating from one thing to another, not making a decision in a timely way. I personally think that there has been at least one wave, possibly two waves, that can be, you know, put at the door of number 10 for not making a decision, you know, fast enough. Now, that doesn't change the fact that when I had a vaccine put in my arm, I cried. The guy was so happy. And of course, I have always wanted, even though I'm a leading figure in the opposition, I have wanted over the last couple of years for the government to succeed. Now, that's a weird place to be when you're in opposition. So politics is odd. Politics is odd, but it's not going to stay like this, because we are hopefully going to move on, and we must work out what kind of society we're going to be, what kind of Britain we want as we come out of the pandemic, because we don't want it to be the same. The question is, what are the changes that we want? What have we learned from this pandemic? And are we going to make sure that we don't just talk about it, because this government's very good at talking about it, but actually do some of the right things? That's what an opposition needs to be doing now.
Paul, actually, a question for you as well. There was a lot of talk before Batley that if it was lost, that Starmer would face a leadership challenge. Do you think, given that Starmer won, that's gone away now? Or is the kind of the left of the party waiting for the next misstep, if there is one?
Well, I think it's definitely gone away for the time being. Obviously, the people who were plotting that leadership challenge were thinking of two things. One is, you know, you said you were not Jeremy Corbyn, and therefore you'd see us increasing the polls, and that's not happened. Or rather, it happened and then it reversed. And the second thing was, you promised all these things in your leadership campaign and you've abandoned them. In other words, you know, key bits of, you know, the last manifesto. So on those two things, they're still a bit uneasy, I think, people in the left of the Labour Party. But I think Batley and Spen, as Emily said, has re-energised the party. I think it's definitely bought him some time. I think what's really interesting is how bold he is and how bothered he is about internal party stuff as opposed to external messaging. And I think there are certainly people around Keir Starmer who would quite like to see the Electoral College return, for example, to make sure that never again could someone like Jeremy Corbyn run the Labour Party. And the jury's out on whether or not he would actually want to go ahead with that fight, because it would be a very bloody fight, you can bet. And I suspect what will happen is they'll wait and see the outcome of the Unite General Secretary election. That could have a big difference. So you're not going to, you know, you wouldn't win a conference vote unless you get Unite votes on that, something that enormous. So I think that's going to be quite interesting. I think that'll be part of that whole debate for now. I think, though, the really interesting thing will be this, just what the public think of Keir Starmer over the next few weeks. You know, he said repeatedly, I'm dying to get out there, as Emily just said, I'm dying to meet people. And there's a 35% of the public still don't really know who he is. Now, that obviously is very, very unusual for an opposition leader. There's this old fashioned sort of mantra that, you know, what the public make of you after the first 6 months in office is it set in stone. That's it. It's cast. And it happened for Duncan Smith, it happened for Haig, you name it. It happened to Ed Miliband to some extent. And but in Starmer's case, it doesn't quite fit that mold, because there's a huge chunk of people who still don't know A, what they think about him, or B, what he stands for. And
well, I mean, the poor man hasn't had a chance. I mean, come on, you know, I mean, he's literally not had a platform to stand on. I mean, there's just not been one. Or if he does stand on a platform, there's nobody else allowed to be in the room. I mean, really, you know, of course he can't be judged in the same way that leaders of the opposition have been.
Yeah, and I think that's the interesting thing there, isn't it, Emily, which is, if things go back to normal, or normal as we knew, the new normal, and he does get out about in the country and he can meet people and he has a normal party conference, then, of course, next May's elections will be another big test for both the government and the opposition. And I think then it will be interesting to see whether or not the party still cuts him some slack, whether or not, you know, if the party can't increase in the polls, and the polls aren't everything, but they are a morale boost. And if having met him, if the public then still don't quite know what they make of him, that's the difficulty, I guess. Don't you think?
I think that when the public have a choice between a prime minister like Boris Johnson and a decent, honourable man, clever, honourable man with principles like Keir Starmer, they will make a clear choice. And they will know that they have had enough of the likes of Boris Johnson. I had enough of this Tory government, and we will get a Labour government. And we just have to remember that, and remember that the country is crying out for an alternative. We need to stick together. And I personally don't think that we should be picking fights with each other. I don't think it's necessary. I think that we just need clear leadership to be told, you know, that's not acceptable. No, we're doing it this way. You know, we're all sticking together, and we need to make it clear that we like ourselves and like each other. You know, I don't think that's, and that shouldn't be impossible. Sometimes I think with some people, I'm not naming any names, but sometimes I do wonder, you know, the amount of kind of venom that some people seem to chuck at one another, you know, other comrades, but you just think, just throw a tenth of that at the Tories and you'd be really good politician. Sometimes people are just like, there's just sort of terrible bad behavior. But, you know, it's a minority of people. The vast majority of people in the membership and in the senior parts of the Labour Party want us to get into government more than anything else, because we know that that is the only way we can change people's lives for the better.
And you reckon, I imagine you'd say that any attempt to sort of go back to an electoral college is just a backward step?
I would say that our priority has to be putting ourselves forward as an alternative government, being clear about who we are and where we're going and what we stand for and what a difference it would make, and making it clear to people that they can believe in politics, because politics can make a difference to people's lives. I think that at the moment, the cynicism about politics helps to feed and support someone like Boris Johnson, who doesn't deliver anything. I know, and actually you need to have a great cynicism about politics to really think that, you know, you might as well just have a joker as prime minister who at least is entertaining on the 10 o'clock news. No, but if you do think that politics can make a difference to your life, then you need to think seriously about what kind of government you want. And I think that we need to be able to be there and giving hope to people and saying, it doesn't have to be like this, there is another way, and we can make a real difference to your life.
And there was quite a contrast, wasn't there, just finally, between Keir Starmer and Boris Johnson when it comes to the football. I mean, Keir Starmer was in his pub, local pub, the Pineapple in Kentish Town, a picture of him with a pint and a football top, an England top. And yet we had the Prime Minister last night in a curious sort of sartorial combo where he had a shirt and then on top of it, an England shirt, and on top of that, a black jacket. I mean, what do you think of that? What do you think the public would think of that?
No idea. I really don't care. I don't, you know, I mean, really, people can wear what they like, you know, whatever. Whatever.
That leads us nicely to the quiz, I suspect.
Yeah, get excited, everyone. It's time for the quiz. Not everyone's a huge football fan, and Paul, you're probably surprised that this is the topic I chose, but I thought I'd keep in literally the country. But luckily, I had Google to make this, so and you guys aren't allowed to. So this is the quiz. I'm going to name you a English football Premier League team.
No way!
Oh, that's not bad.
And I want you to tell me who their MP is. It's based on where they're...
Emily will have an advantage on this. She knows many
based on where their stadium
is. I can't remember people's names, though. That's the trouble. I mean, I'm a woman of a certain age.
So, okay, here we go. Manchester United.
Oh, is that... They're only born to the sound of the roar of the...
Stratford End.
Well, not that close, because it's Kate Green.
Ah, Urmston, yeah, Stratford and Urmston, yeah.
Okay. Next one, Brighton and Hove. I picked it because it's my hometown. The Lloyd Amex
Russell
Stadium.
Moore. Ooh.
Peter Who's Kyle? The MP?
Peter Kyle. Yeah, Peter Kyle might be. Peter Kyle. Not Peter Kyle.
We'll say that again.
Well, then it's Caroline, is it?
No, it's not Peter Kyle.
And then Lloyd Russell Moyle.
Oh.
Well, hang on. Those are the MPs of Brighton.
Blimey. Is it in Lewis? Is that
a trick question? Lewis?
Yeah. Yeah, it's so it's Maria Caulfield, Tory, it's Lewis.
That was a good trick question.
Yeah, it's opposite the university, which is in a little village called Fama, which isn't actually in Brighton. Yeah. Okay, just two
this
more.
Is painful,
so Fulham. Yeah. Craven Cottage is Fulham's ground. He's the MP. Emily, it's sort of related to your job in a sense. That's my clue.
Oh, Fulham MP. Is that Greg Hands?
Yeah, it's Greg Hands.
Your favourite MP, Emily? One of your favourites.
Okay, one more, the last one. Put everyone out of their misery. In honour of Arj, the former host of this podcast, Leeds, Alan Rode. Who's the MP for Leeds?
Oh, God. Is that Hilary Benn?
It is, yeah. It's Leeds Central. It's Hilary Benn. Well done, Paul.
Central. That was just a guess, random guess.
Okay.
I had no prior knowledge.
Yeah, yeah. Right. Thanks, Paul. Thank you, Emily. We'll end now. We'll end with the Prime Minister being repeatedly asked by Labour's Chris Bryant yesterday whether he did or didn't, in fact, sack Matt Hancock.
No, I'm thinking, did you sack Matt Hancock?
Well, let me continue at this point.
Did you sack Matt Hancock?
Let me give you an example. Of the £350 million a week. This was a figure that related to the gross sum that the UK gave to the EU budget. It was a subject of lively controversy during the referendum campaign 5 years ago, as you remember. Actually, it turned out, if anything, Sir Bernard, to be a slight underestimate. And by this year, the gross figure
did
would have been
sack
considerably
Matt
higher. On your question about Mr. Hancock, the former health secretary, let me just go back to what I said many, many times, and I think I said on the floor of the House of Commons, which was that we read about, and I think you read about, we all read about the story concerning Mr. Hancock and CCTV and so forth on, I think, the Friday. And we had a new health secretary on the Saturday. And considering that we are in the middle of a global pandemic, and it's quite a thing to move your health secretary, Mr. Bryant, I think that was quite fast going, if I may say so. And that's all I have to say on that matter.
This is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.